Good morning. For those of you who don't know me, I'm Kaisa, and I am an AMBS student. So I have a cynical side that I don't like to admit to. It's the part of me that wants to say, it's never that simple, or that's so unrealistic. So when I think about anybody following a star to find Jesus, my first tendency is to dismiss it. Complete fantasy. Somebody made that up. And then I start asking questions. Did the Magi know where they were going when they set out? What did they do when it was cloudy and they couldn't see the star? Did they wait, or did they keep going in the direction where they'd last seen it? Did they have the faith to trust that it was still there even when they couldn't see it? And do I have that kind of faith? Since I was asked to speak this morning, I read the familiar story more carefully, looking for what it might be saying in the present, and specifically about my journey towards seminary. I actually wonder if reading it with that in mind was what made me ask those specific questions. I confess that it took me 8 years to move to Elkhart and start seminary because I wasn't very good at trusting that the light was still there, even when I couldn't see it. My first nudge towards seminary actually came in high school. I attended a week-long summer camp through my Lutheran church each summer. It was called Leadership Lab, but at the time it didn't even occur to me that there was anything significant about the word leadership in the name. During my third summer there, a pastor who was one of my group leaders suggested that I might want to consider going into ministry. My high school self thought that was utterly absurd, and I certainly didn't recognize it as a twinkle of guidance. I mostly laughed it off and forgot about it. For a decade or so, during and after college, I ignored church altogether. I had decided it was something that people just did because it's what you do. They didn't do it out of commitment to God or to the community. Then I accidentally discovered Mennonites. That was God's guidance, although I can only see that looking back. I went to church with a musician friend to hear her play and came away with the feeling that there was something going on there that was different from the Lutheran churches I'd attended in the past. Or maybe there was just something new stirring in me. Suddenly, I wanted to go to church again. When I started attending First Mennonite in Urbana, Illinois in 2010, I had already started making plans to move to Colorado. But I still dove in and got involved in the church community for the year that I was there, and started to realize that there were a lot of people who had gone to seminary with no plans to be a pastor. In that light, the nudge I'd been given in high school didn't seem quite so absurd after all. I moved to Colorado in the fall of 2011 and attended Boulder Mennonite. Shortly after I arrived in Boulder, I was talking with someone who said, "This might sound strange, but have you ever considered going to seminary?" And this was the first conversation that I had had with this person. I think that's when I started really taking the idea seriously, especially since I had peeked at a couple of seminary websites a week or so earlier. I visited the AMBS campus for the first time that fall when I drove through Indiana on the way to Tennessee for a week with Christian Peacemaker teams. I loved my visit, which included a potluck, a movie night, sitting in on a class, and a generally warm welcome. Then I went back to Boulder. At some point during the next couple of years, I also visited Iliff School of Theology in Denver. I would have fit in there, but something didn't feel right the way it had at AMBS. I was growing more and more certain that I wanted to attend AMBS, but instead of committing to that and moving back to the Midwest, I decided to move to Fort Collins and get an apartment with my girlfriend and her 8-year-old son. Instead of trusting God's guidance to still be leading me towards seminary, I made a giant course change. A year later, with my self-esteem crushed I tore myself away from that relationship and decided to trust that even if I couldn't see the star, it was still there. In late 2014, I moved back to Champaign-Urbana and back to First Mennonite. I got an office job at the University of Illinois to save some money for tuition, and I started working on recovering the self-esteem that I had let be destroyed. Ironically, the office culture where I worked ended up repeating some of the same emotionally abusive patterns. And I realized that if I stayed there, I was probably not going to have the mental and emotional resources to make the move to seminary, even if I did have the money. So I quit my job. I signed up for my first online seminary class, which was Biblical Hebrew. I applied for admission as an on-campus student. I got a job that barely paid the bills, stocking produce in a grocery store, but I was working with a manager I knew and trusted. And miraculously, I started to get my self-esteem back. Because it felt good to be there, I was strongly tempted to stay in that job and give up on my seminary dream again. But somehow, this time, I found the strength to trust that God's leading hadn't changed. I finally found my way to my destination, and I'm confident now that I'm in the right place, even though I don't know what the next steps will be. I still wonder how much of my presence here is luck, because sometimes God does ask you to change your plans. The Magi changed their plans because of a dream from God. Again, that seems to me like a massive amount of trust. How do you tell the difference between a dream from God and just an ordinary dream? After the practice of following the star when it was hidden from view, how did they adjust their thinking to incorporate new instructions from God? This morning, the Epiphany story speaks to me of the tension between being called to persevere and being called to make a change. My path to seminary has had elements of both, as well as failures to do both. Telling the difference is something I'm sure I'll continue to struggle with. But now I've found a new story to turn to when I need a reminder that it's not just me. We all live in the tension between continuing in the same direction and changing course. My prayer for myself and for each of you is that we can be attuned to God's guidance in our lives, whatever form that takes. Amen.
I'm going to start with a sentence that I doubt has ever been said from up front at assembly. Here's an interesting thing about grant writing. Many grant applications start with something called a statement of the problem. This is where you describe in great detail what is wrong in your neighborhood, city, state. It could be high crime, low income, health problems, famines, earthquakes, wars, rumors of wars. Basically, the message is, we're doing horribly, and we're all going to die unless you send us some money. Then later in grant applications, they ask you for something called organizational capability and capacity. And this is where you describe in great detail how your organization or project is just so amazing and wonderful that you will be able to fix all these terrible problems with just a little bit of help. And that's kind of how I feel coming into Epiphany this year. The statement of the problem in the world is very stark. You have asylum-seeking families crammed into detention centers, opioids becoming the new drug epidemic, while people of color still recover from unequal treatment during the previous drug wars. You have economic anxiety, both real for many and a scapegoating technique for others. You have warfare, poverty, and disease all around the world. You have a lot of yelling. I mean, last year we needed a sermon called Joy in a Time of Climate Change. It's so hard to see the light. It's so hard to see that if things are getting any better. You can almost sympathize with those early Christians who just hunkered down waiting for Jesus to return. And you can see why some modern believers can succumb to the toxic idea that the world is just going to get worse until the second coming. But things aren't so unilaterally hopeless as they seem. Hans Rosling, the late Swedish health expert and public speaker, outlined why in his recent book, Factfulness, 10 Reasons Why We're Wrong About the World and Why Things Are Better Than You Think. Rosling reminds us that in the U.S., crime continues to be well below where it was 25 years ago, and globally, deaths from violence continue to drop. Gender inequality in educational access has greatly decreased. We've made great strides fighting AIDS and global poverty. So why the disconnect? Well, first, bad news is easier to find than ever. Technology makes it easier to be connected to the whole world. And in many parts of the world, a freer press means more problems are getting the attention they need. Rosling says, alongside all the other improvements, our surveillance of suffering has improved tremendously. This exacerbates our brain's evolutionary tendency to notice threats and negative changes more quickly than positive ones. We were supposed to see the lion in the brush very quickly. Not that he says all is well. He also describes ways things are still bad, the impending consequences of climate change and growing economic inequality. But he encourages us to put global trends in perspective. He talks about the world being bad, but better. Quote, I'm not an optimist. I'm a very serious possibilist, he writes. I see all this progress and it fills me with conviction and hope that further progress is possible. Keep in mind that the positive changes may be more common, but they don't find you. You need to find them. This was a powerful instruction to me heading into Epiphany. Every Advent and Christmas and Epiphany season, I wonder, where is God with us today? What is God doing? Where is the light in the darkness? It's good for me, and I think for all of us, to be reminded, we are not where the light comes from. That light, as John wrote, has been with us since the beginning, long before God created humans, been around longer than any of us have been. This week, as we celebrate Epiphany, we are reminded that the light has been with God's people through dark times, going back to Isaiah, when he wrote, "Arise, shine, for your light has come, and the glory of the Lord has risen upon you." That was in the present tense. When Jesus came as the incarnation of the light, it's the people who were in great darkness, both the politically oppressed Jews and those on the margins of Jewish society. So great darkness in the world is nothing new, but neither is the light. So this year, I guess I have to ask a different question. Instead of searching for the light to cheer myself up, I feel like I'm supposed to share the light I know exists through Jesus Christ. This in particular hit me last week during Paul Keim's paraphrase of John 1. Light continues to shine forth in the darkness, and the darkness has not been able to extinguish it. John, the Baptist, was a person sent from God to reflect the light so that everyone might be enveloped in its glow. John was not a light source, but came in order to mirror its luminosity. Pro tip, by the way, only quote Paul Keim in English. So how can I reflect the light today? In 2019, that means more to me than just being a nice person, praying before meals, and inviting people to church. Where I feel called to reflect light is in my conversations, both offline and online. If darkness can be spread by word of mouth and by social media, can light? At small group dinner last week, we were discussing climate change and how hard it was to feel like we as individuals can do anything about it. That night, while I was having my nightly fix on Twitter of baseball rumors, cat videos, and political hot takes, I found a thread by a meteorologist and writer about the most effective things individuals can do about climate change. Number one, he said, was to talk about it. Quote, the reason talking is so effective is simple. The average American only has 1 to 2 conversations about climate change each year. If you can double that for someone, they can double it for someone else, and we can quickly build political momentum for radical action. I think the same approach can be applied to whatever darkness you feel called to reflect light into. Share with those around you, whether in person or in writing or via social media. Be willing to listen, to learn, to love your enemies, real or perceived. This is the challenge I'm giving myself in 2019, rather than continue to join those yelling at the darkness. I'm so thankful for those who reflect the light to me when my strength is low. That includes this church community, my friends scattered around the world, and the new voices I meet online who reflect the light. I am particularly excited by social media's ability to spread the views of women and people of color, both within the church and outside of it. Spread those voices. Give their books as gifts. Share their ideas with friends. Promote the prophets and the possibilists. Retweets are endorsements. Just yesterday, I saw this tweet by philosopher and professor James K. Smith. I think it's a good call to action. And he's had it as his pinned tweet at the top of his profile for almost a year now. There is so much good work to do. Make beautiful things. Build institutions. Throw parties. Change a party. Learn a language. Visit the sick. Make babies. Raise children. Go to a city council meeting. Go to church. Listen. Pray. Play. Hope. Love. So for 2019, my statement of the problem is, there's a lot of darkness. But my organizational capability is, the light is always with us. And there are so many people reflecting that light.